Hey everyone, welcome back. We're ready for a new series of episodes here on Mental Health Matters. This time we're going to be talking exclusively about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. We hope to give you a little bit of an insight into understanding what ADHD is all about, how to go about treating it and supporting our kids with it, what the role of medication is, and so much more on this awesome series that we are so excited to bring to you. And I hope you enjoy this episode and the entire series.
Welcome. My name is Yechiel Bressler, Assistant Director and Therapist at Upward Community. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, the podcast where we do a deep dive into the mental health challenges confronting the Orthodox Jewish community. Join us as we identify, explore, and open up the conversation about some of the biggest struggles facing our community today.
Dr. Fell, thank you so much for giving us your time out of your busy schedule and for being open with us and for the sake of our listeners.
Sure. My absolute pleasure. There's nothing more than me loving to hear myself talk about myself. So I'm really excited to do this. I really enjoy hearing myself talk about me. And so please.
That's great. Thank you. And DJ, again, thank you for joining me and for hosting.
Also my pleasure. And I'm also looking forward to the doctor talking about himself.
Thanks, DJ.
All right. I thought you were going to talk about yourself. So
that's my favorite subject too, but this isn't about me.
I know. I feel like it's like, how do I navigate both of this from both of you? Two people who love to talk about themselves.
Look at this. Hachnasas Orchim, DJ.
That's right. So Dr. Fell, let's start. You know, I don't know where you want to start, but just start wherever you want to start.
Bereshis bara Elohim as people. And then there was like a weird glitch in the factory. And then ADHD folk got out. Once we escaped, we obviously just spread Ufaratzta, you know, Abakamfis Aret. Now we're everywhere. And so really, I'm making a joke, but it's not. It's because I want to bring out something, which is that there's no mistakes. Like, Akash Baruch didn't make a mistake. And I was born this way, to quote Lady Gaga, because this is clearly what Akash Baruch wanted from me. But unfortunately, I never really knew that. In the beginning, when we first started this journey, I kind of wish I did. I don't know what difference it would have made. Like, what would you have been able to help the 8-year-old getting expelled by saying, you know, Hashem loves you and you're not a mistake? I don't know. Maybe if my Rebbeim had that attitude, it maybe would have been easier. Yeah, I did. I certainly did not know that. I wish I knew it even in kindergarten when I was slashing children with a stegosaurus. Great move. No, DJ, what else do you use the stegosaurus for?
I'm going to decline to comment on that based on the schooling that I went to, where dinosaurs were not considered real.
Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot. It's a very from crowd.
Yes, that's right.
So the point is that it really all started when I was a kid. I think my mother likes saying over that she wanted to put me in school right away, like into kindergarten. I don't even know what the first thing is. But my grandparents are very, like, you know, hesitant. That was the first grandchild. Like, a kid should be by their mother. All of that beautiful stuff, attachment theory and all. And my mother's like, no, you don't understand. This kid is crazy. Like, really, I can't.
What did you do that you were crazy? Like, tell us, who was this kid? Who you're talking about this kid, but who was this kid?
This is preschool age years, right? So preschool age years, I'd already dumped the entire, you know, the genie thing that you put all the diapers in? When you still think that that's like a smart idea. And then, you know, I mean, obviously you reach a point where you just get practical and you chuck them wherever they land. But in the beginning, a lot of couples have this like genie. So I was the first kid of oldest. So they had the genie, right? And they would shove the garbage stuff in there. So when I discovered that I literally had an entire magazine filled with ammo, lock, stock, and barrel, like that was the coolest thing in the world. That discovery was amazing. And like, I think I would just either dump them first off the marpeset, right? My parents lived in Yerushalayim when my father was in the mirror. So I would just like dump them off. They're like, you know, like sniping them down. That was pretty awesome. I mean, that was a lot of chifetz chashuds coming down from the top of that apartment building. And so that was, I guess, bad, but like still kind of cute. You could kind of smirk about it. I think they got a little bit less smirky when I dumped it into my little brother's crib. Because they were like, it's suffocation, no breathing, don't give a... That was Papa Roach for you, DJ.
I got that. And I liked how you were throwing out these dirty bombs, you know, in the whole neighborhood.
Yeah. Thank God. Yeah, it hasn't stopped. Still kind of make a mess wherever I go. But I think that's when they were like, all right, this is just dangerous. It didn't help that my mom was on bed rest. I mean, that basically meant that I had a rule of the roost. and a lot of energy. And so like stuff like that, like soldiers bringing me back to the apartment because I had escaped, and they had to bring the inmate back in for processing. It's like these kinds of stories. I was barely even three. I don't think I was even like, because we were only in RTSO for 3 years. So I couldn't have been older than three. And all of this already happened then. Quite the rap sheet, honestly. Pretty impressive now that I think about it.
See, but now that you're talking about and you have all these things, how do you know the difference between a general terrible two and what you're saying is describing, you know, ADHD or something?
That's a great question, honestly. And I think I'll save that for when we get to like the clinical part. At this point, no one knew about ADHD. I'm saying like my father grew up in England. Like, we're pretty sure he was the one with ADHD, even though my mother's brothers have it too. So even though he had it, he told me that as a kid, he would like have to force himself to concentrate. Otherwise they'd beat him with a hickory stick. He said like he remembers being beaten out the window. Like they would make him like lean out the window and then beat his bare bottom. And like that's the way they dealt with ADHD back then. So he would obviously be very motivated to concentrate, but he couldn't. He said he would concentrate so hard and for so long he would get splitting headaches. He was taking Advil when he was, I think, a young kid, like in elementary school already, for his headaches, like popping them like Skittles. And like it was really, really tough. So like they didn't know about it. I don't think anyone knew about it back then. My therapist has a great line on that, which is he's like, a lot of people try giving Rabam a pass, saying, oh, they didn't know about all these things. So that's why they were mean and nasty. He's like, yeah, but the good Rebaim didn't either know. And I think very much that's what it comes down to. The answer to the question is, it doesn't really matter whether or not you got the kid a diagnosis. Till six, they're not giving you meds. So you just got to be a mensch as a parent and be able to self-regulate yourself and earn your manhood points, no matter what the diagnosis is.
Who was that to? Was that to parents, to Rebaim, or to in general?
This was to parents, Rebaim, anyone who wants to try to take care of a human being. That it starts with emotional self-regulation, or to quote the famous airline thing, first regulate yourself before you regulate the person next to you.
So you were off the charts here already at a very young age. What was next?
So then we moved back to New York, take this kid from like Sanhedrin or Merchevet, you know, like super chari little dude. And then you drop him off in New York City. So it was pretty intense. The continuation of that story was that, so now that they got back to New York, we would go to the grandparents for Shabbos. Yay, right? And I think after that first Shabbos, my grandfather was like, I see. Okay, yeah, I hear preschool. That makes sense. Yeah, maybe you should. It was pretty intense. I mean, as we're talking about, I'm feeling bad for my parents. Yeah, which that's just really, really tough. And then from there, so I went to an elementary school that was nearby. It was actually, I think, a feeder school for my father's yeshiva. And it's like been involved with her family for years. That just makes it even bigger Kiddush that I got expelled from that place. That was pretty hard. So that barely lasted a year. Then from there, I went to another yeshiva, like a little bit more out of town, which in those days just meant like Long Island, because I was like considered out of town. And they were supposed to be more easygoing there, more accommodating. So sweet. All types are welcome here. And that didn't either work out. I think it was a thing within 2 years, I'd already kicked the principal and was asked not so politely to leave and never come back. This is after obviously consistently stealing from all the scholastic book fairs and, you know, imitating teachers and riling up stuff. So then I went back to this other school, again, another one that my family was very involved in. And my parents were really hoping it would work out. The staff all kind of knew me. I think the principal was even chavrusas with my grandfather, you know, like I really had the protexia there. But I guess that didn't help when I was caught, you know, lighting the building on fire.
What is that? What do you mean lighting the building on fire?
So basically, so I found the bag of matches when I was like 8 or 9. And so I brought them to school because, hey, you know, fire is fun. And also I follow safety rules. They say, don't try this at home. I did not try this at home. And so I brought it to school and I was showing kids the cool stuff you could do when you flick a match on the box thing and then it like makes a twirl and lights on fire. It was kind of cool. They should have put me on like America's Got Talent, me and Bono, that clown guy. And unfortunately though, the problem was that where I was doing that was the recycling center. So there was all the like cardboard boxes, newspaper stacked up. That's a thing in case anyone is listening to this podcast in a year or two from now. They used to have this thing called newspapers, which were made out of combustible material. People would sit down and read a finite limited amount of information in one sitting. And they actually would pay attention from the beginning of it to the end of it, almost like undisturbed. you couldn't break them out of it. And then that was it. They were happy. They got up and they went on with their day. Weird thing, but you know how it was back in the old crazy days. So they didn't really appreciate that, the school. And yeah, I was expelled for that. This is like, again, I'm not even like mentioning all of the like fights and slamming kids' heads into the water fountain because it's fun and their head's already there. So why not just...
Can I ask you a question just listening to all this?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think that's where we're going to go here. Just, you know, this casual interrupting style. You know, I mean, just listening to this, how are you feeling about yourself? Like, was this just like fun, like exciting? Like, this is your entertainment? Are you...
Yeesh, he'll ask you the tough questions.
Try.
How did I feel about it? It's hard to know. I think in the moment, I probably didn't feel anything. There's this beautiful concept that I write about in my book called the stream of stimulation, which is that people with ADHD, and it's really most people, but much more pronounced than people with ADHD, we get caught in a stream of stimulation and we just keep going from one stimulus to the next, never pausing to stop. The reason why we don't pause to stop is because we're afraid of what's going to happen when we do. There's a part of us that knows. And as we all are familiar, the body keeps score. And it knows. And it may want to try to ensure to not have to find out what it's going to be. And there's another like delicious concept called TSA. D is for delayed, S for sensory affect. The A is affect, delayed sensory affect, which is that we're not feeling our sensory cues until that stream of stimulation has stopped. I also call this in more clinical terms, the I have to make effect, right? You ever had kids watching a show or something like that and watching you, hey, anyone need to make? No, anyone want to drink? No, anyone? No, no, everyone's great, right? 7 minutes later, as soon as the thingy ends, I have to make! All of a sudden, everyone has to make, and they're all tired and hungry and thirsty. So what's happening is that they're in the stream of stimulation, right? They're just watching, and you see them glued to the screen, right? And it's just going stimulus to stimulus to stimulus that it almost overpowers or kind of like washes over the sensory stimulus, the cues that are happening inside us. So therefore, we're not necessarily in touch with the cues, our internal bodily cues, until the stream of stimulation has ended. And I know you're laughing because like, oh, it's cute for kids. This happens to us also as adults, right? You're going from email to meeting to client to meeting to email to this to that. When you finally get home and you're like, oh, sweet, right? I can relax, or that first second of like breath of calm as you like turn the front door, and then bam, get assaulted by, here, hold this kid, your son just, right? And then you have the mommy bothering me, talk to your father, right? And it's just like, now all of a sudden you're getting this like slam. It's just like all of your feelings from the whole day though are finally now allowed to come out. And no wonder that daddy's tense, irritable, and like kind of little nasty sometimes. It's because that's the first time our body has been able to process the fact that you just literally worked with that client who you hate. And or with that really, really tough story with the client whose mother just passed away and now their father's sick in hospice. And like, where are you carrying all of that? When did you process that? A smoke break sometimes is not enough, right? And so like the idea of like DSA means that for us also, the delayed sensory affect hits us when we get home, when we're finally able to stop. So going back to your question, as a kid, I think I was too caught in that stream of stimulation to ever have those DSAs. And whenever I did, right, the delayed sensory affect would lead to this like overwhelm of feelings. I would have so much happening at once, and I almost like I would feel too much. I remember being very rageful as a child. When I went to like my first real psychotherapy, what I mean by real is that my parents obviously dragged me from one therapist to the next. Including that, by the way, the great story where they took me to someone very, very expensive, who I then ended up having as a graduate school professor. but they took me to someone very expensive, and I just sat there with my arms crossed. And no, I didn't talk the whole time. I did not talk the entire time. And I remember my father dragging me out by the ear. You know how expensive that was, right? And it's just like, yeah. So like those therapy sessions weren't necessarily so effective. I wouldn't either talk. And I think it was, again, it was just too much for me to handle. I couldn't. And if it would come out, I was just so overwhelmed by that feeling that I couldn't necessarily share it, nor did I have the vocabulary or ability to articulate what was going on inside me. But I do remember that the first like real therapist, like the one I like first connected to, when I was in WITS, I went to a therapist in LA, Dr. David Fox. He was excellent. And I remember like the first session we had, he goes, wow, you have a lot of rage. Yeah, I'm impulsive. He's like, what does that have to do with rage? I was like, because I get angry very easily. He's like, so, but there's like deep smoldering rage in here and ADHD doesn't cover that. And now I thought I knew, like I was being a smart tuchus, right? And I was telling him, yeah, it's just right. I was like, oh yeah, I have all the answers, ADHD, that's why. And it was cool that he like poked me and pushed me and pride. And like, I remember the drive back home, you know, down Mulholland Drive from Beverly Hills to where my house is. So I'm driving past these gorgeous homes and top down. I was obviously driving the convertible and system up, probably Katy Perry. You could edit that. I remember just like the music blaring and just like letting myself settle and digest and hearing, oh my God, I am a really angry person. Holy cow. And it was kind of scary for me to realize that. Like, apparently you were onto something, Yekiel. I was feeling stuff, but I wasn't necessarily so aware of it until literally 16 mm-hmm. years later.
It's powerful. So like subconsciously, were you happy as a kid?
I don't think so. No, probably not. I was fun, but I don't know if I was happy. It depends. I mean, if you were the kid that was helping me schlep the giant garbage bag of snow onto the bus, probably fun. Right. If you were the kid that we then dumped the giant garbage bag of snow on the bus, not so
fun. That's what I was going to say. It sounded like you were having fun. Right.
But to be more accurate, yeah. I was having stimulation.
Yes.
Fun was, again, I was looking for stimulation that was enjoyable. Like, we're not going to go for like the, I mean, that would be a whole new level of really, really challenged and limited and trauma if I was burning myself or something, chas v'shalom. But no, Baruch Hashem, I was not doing that. I was looking for like the more positive, fun kinds of stimulus, burning other people.
See, but like to me, you just like, I hear that and I hear the DSA and I'm wondering, like, because that sounds like it has forethought to it. Like, I found this matches. What am I going to do with it? I'm not using it right now. I'm going to save it to use it at school. So like,
I don't know if it was save it. I think it was more like, whoa, this is cool. Let me show my friends.
So it was like holding off on using it when you found it to show your friends.
Because that's way more stimulating and exciting than just standing there with a bag of matches at home.
Right. So I'm saying I'm distinguishing.
Between what? Like impulsive? That was still impulsive. Or do you mean like really smart, great planning impulsive? Yeah.
No. What I mean is it's still impulsive, but it also had some, you had some ability to delay. So like how would me looking at a kid say, oh, he planned that ahead. When really that's just an elongated overstimulation where you just can't wait to get to school to do it.
True. Yeah. And I think that really what you're asking comes down to a much deeper question, which we could save for another time, but I'll say it here and you guys can do with it what you want, which is that a lot of times we view ADHD as broken, right? That they are executive functioning deficits. But I had a fascinating conversation and many drinks with Dr. Bill Dodson at the International Conference for ADHD in Baltimore this past November. And he added a beautiful point that really resonated with me, especially after two gin and tonics, which was that he's been working with people with ADHD for over 30 years. And he said that almost every single one he asked them this one question. He says, has there ever been anything that you've been really interested in that you couldn't do? Not that you wanted to do like your taxes or your homework or your quarterly report, but something you're really interested in doing that you were not able to figure out. He says a lot of times they'll go, you mean like even in childhood? I'd be like, yeah, go for it. Adult, child, whatever. And they would sit there thinking. Point is, it would take them time to try to think of that. Meaning there wasn't like this flood of unsuccessful or inadequate. Or it's like, because most of them were unstoppable. Anything they wanted to do, anything they were really interested in, something that grabbed their brain, that grabbed their mind, they were unstoppable. He's like, and you're going to tell me that that person has executive functioning deficit? All of a sudden, there's the amazing planning and forethought and all these other executive functions that come online. You can say he's broken. He's not broken. It's just he's working with a different operating system. And this operating system is just interest. iOS interest. Internal operating system of interest. That's it. Just to contrast, right? Normal people, the neurotypicals among us, right? So probably you, Yechiel, right? You're probably more motivated by two very logical things. Whether something's important or beneficial. Sounds pretty simple, right? You'll do something if it's important. You'll be motivated to do something if it's important or if you see that there's benefit to you or to something or to this thing. Us, with ADHD, those neurodiverse folk among us, yeah, it's great. We'll know it's important. We'll even see the benefit, but it's just not grabbing us unless it's interesting. The brain's just not on. It's just not on. You see it. You see it in kids with ADHD when it's like, all right, Shlaimi, you ready to do the math homework? And like their whole body is just like, bluch. But video games, that kid's up there, you know, crawling, like climbing on the couch, playing the thing, also getting popcorn while still playing and like, you know, never missing a beat in his Fortnite game. While, like, it's just incredible. Like they're off the charts.
Could that also be true of like a motivational tactic at that point? Like if you do your math homework, I'll give you $5. And like, I don't care.
It depends. It has to be interesting. It's not benefit itself is not always gonna work. That's why I think a lot of ill-fated attempts made by many yeshivas with chakras and points and money, it doesn't work because it's not working for us. It's not speaking to us. It's just not.
Wait, so hold on. We're already in episode 2 here. Hold on, guys. We got to get back to Lil Nas. How did you get from being this? The last we heard is you got kicked out of three schools, right? After lighting the school on fire because that was your interest and you didn't care about anything else. And now you're like talking about like, hold on, I'm a doctor felt and I'm dying felt and I'm who knows what else I am.
Well, I wasn't showing off about that stuff, but you could do that. That's great. I love hearing that. So yeah, let's continue going. I think a lot of what changed was moving out of town. We moved to like real out of town, which was San Diego, California. You know, good old co-ed classes, like really sweet people. Everyone just nice and gentle and laid back. So they didn't know what hit them. Oh my God, right? This kid in like this whirlwind from New York, Storm Nahi incoming. It was a huge storm, DJ. It was huge. I think that was, again, it was a culture shift for me, but it did help because like there wasn't as, like there was so much more acceptance of everyone. This was like the only Jewish school. This was the only shul. This was the only options. So it's almost as if like they were forced to kind of accommodate and work with me. But I don't like the word accommodations as much as I like the word accept. I still remember that even though I was constantly getting all these pink slips for kicking Abigail in the stomach and for disrupting, you know, class and this and that, Mrs. Lipo, was that her name? I think her name was Mrs. Lipo. She was the principal. I still remember she took me to her house for a sleepover with her husband. We watched a football game or something like that together. And I had my own little room. And she like really invested in me, you know, as like a person, not just as like a troublemaker. She's a great line that I love telling my grad students, which is try to see the person behind the pathology. And now I just, as we're talking, I'm realizing where I got that from, which was from Mrs. Lipo. I really felt like there I was seen as a person, not just a troublemaker, not just as a pathology.
And you felt that already as a kid?
Yeah, I did feel like that. I did feel like all I did was cause trouble. Like almost like, you know, like they say like, oh, he has hands of gold. So I had like hands of kryptonite. It was something that I felt like there was almost like that was just me. I was just a bad kid. I was a troublemaker. I was terrible. I was horrible. And there was nothing I could do to do it better. I was on every single program and every single medication and taking all sorts of, you would get prizes for this and prizes for that, incentives, belted as a child, beaten, everything. You name it, they did it. You know, and they were trying their best to just figure out what's the right thing to do for this kid. I felt their frustration. I felt their like, oh my God, right? Kids are very sensitive. We pick up the feelings of the adults around us and what those people around us really feel about us. I was very lucky to be Zocha to have really, really special people who took an interest in me and cared about me. One of the biggest impacts of my life was Rabbi Dr. Chaim Feuerman. I used to hang out at his house every Shabbos. I would go to him. We would learn together. And we would schmooze. I even started when I was dating, I brought the girl I was dating with me. And then we kept going, we were married, brought our kids. He always gave me this feeling that not only was I good enough, but that I was amazing and special. He's the one who pushed me to become Dr. Nahi. He pushed me to get a PhD. I remember I was like, bro, I can't even like finish a Bechina, like to do the weekly Bechias test. Like, I'm like, you want me to get a PhD? I can't do that. And he pushed me. He even wrote my letter of recommendation to Harvard. Like, he really believed in me. And
how did he convince you?
He just gave off this vibe of like, I like you and I think you're special. And he used to say this when we talk about being a good Rebbe. He would say part of being a good Rebbe is not only liking the kid, you have to even like his lizard collection because they feel it. They feel it. And if you don't like the kid, he's not love them. Rebbe Trenk. He loved the Talmidim. Every Rebbe loves the Talmidim. He says you have to like them. That's the key. The kid will know whether or not you like them. How many kids are you talking to or adults you talk to in therapy who say, yeah, I know my father loved me, but, right? And then you had all that stuff. Because love isn't enough. And contrary to all those songs, love is not the answer. It's deep respect and appreciation of this person. And that's what I got from Rabbi Feuerman. And I was lucky to get that from many other very influential figures in my life. I got that a lot from Dr. Palkowitz, Dr. Blumenthal. Dr. Blumenthal was the one who pushed me into ADHD. He outed me. When I was in the middle of class, he was talking about ADHD. And as he started, it was like 9:15 in the morning. He's like, yeah, we're going to be talking about ADHD. And I'm like, oh, great. I'm that. And I picked up my pill that I had not yet taken, as evidenced by the impulsive shout out to the entire class. And he said, can you please talk to me after class? And I'm like, oh, I felt like I was right back in like second grade, you know, getting in trouble. He said, you know, actually, I'm giving a presentation on ADHD for OL. Would you want to join me? I was so flabbergasted and relieved that I wasn't in trouble that I actually said yes. and then had a panic attack right afterwards because like I had never spoken about it. To me, ADHD was always shameful. It was always my embarrassing weakness that I had to declare when I'm going to tell my wife, you know, on the sixth date, on the eighth date. By the way, she had already, I found printouts. She had already asked her aunt, who's a special ed like specialist and assistant principal at SAR Academy in Riverdale. She had already asked about ADHD, gotten all these printouts about ADHD after the first date. My mentor, Dr. Ari Tucker, always says ADHD is the worst kept secret. You know, like I thought, oh, I have to say it, the sixth, the seventh. She was already on to me after the first date. She already had asked her own shy Liz on whether or not she was comfortable with doing this or not, moving ahead with a guy who's nuts. And she was okay with it. So like me, like living in my head of when I'm going to say it and this and that. It's just funny the way that these things work out. But I had these amazing people who believed in me. And that's really what I think answers your question of how did I get from Little Nachi, you know, the arsonist burning down schools and beating up and terrorizing the local children, to becoming this big-hearted, amazingly successful doctor and professor and Diane, is that I had these very special people who believed in me and conveyed that respect and appreciation for me, and I took that and ran with it.
That's super powerful. Super, super powerful. You ended up dying, right? So you had this whole wits.
Oh, I did episode. Have a wits episode. Wits, I think wits. I just on the honorable mentions of people that had a really, really, really helpful, positive effect on me. I just want to mention Dr. Martin Galla, who was my first boss. Like, also, like, I was making all these ADHD mistakes, saying weird, stupid stuff in sessions that made clients uncomfortable. So for any therapist out there listening to this who's going through that, I was there. I did that also, and that's okay. You could turn out all right. Like, he believed in me, pushed, like, really, like, pushed me to get better, accepted my sincere apology, and worked with me on a plan for how to get better. Like, these are just, like, a really amazing people. My dissertation chair, the person who helped me get the actual PhD, Dr. Eric Hickey, also, like, adopted me like a son. Like, I really had so many special people who believed in me, and that's really how I got this far, is through having the special people. And the research shows, even with kids who go through tremendous traumas, if you're familiar with the adverse childhood, the experience, it's like a sheet that you give kids an intake, and they ask about how terrible their life was. Anyone over, I think, a 4 or a 6 has a significantly increased likelihood of, you know, dying young, juvenile delinquency, STDs, getting into stupid, like, high impulsive, high risk accidents and stuff like that, and developing mental health disorders and ending up homeless, than people who didn't, right? And obviously, as your score goes higher, your likelihood of being doomed is higher. But they say that they found that the protective factor is having at least one adult caregiver or an older caregiver who believed in you. And I feel like that's, you know, can't be any more true than in my story, in my case, of how I really was like one of those unsalvageable terrors. And it shows the effect of having someone who believes in someone, believes in you and appreciates you and gives you that respect, and how far that can go. And it's much harder for parents to do that because we have so much involved. It's our own skin, flesh and blood, and there's so much more insecurities and countertransference going on. So it's much harder for parents. So parents, don't beat yourselves up. It's normal for you to be a little nastier than the Rebbe. Rebbeim, though, yeah, you don't get paid enough to do that. But if you did, if you were able to find it in your hearts to love a kid and to do more than that, to like the kid and to see what he's into and respect him for who he is as a person, you could really do amazing things.
That's, everything is tremendously powerful. And so what I want to ask is for the Rebbe that thinks he's doing that, and you said specifically, I think you said something that you didn't feel like you had that until you were 19. So for the Rebbe that before you're 19 that thinks he's doing that.
I had one, third grade, Rabbi Schwartz, Rabbi Yehuda Schwartz. I remember I got an Aleph Plus in his class, and my parents thought there was a typo. He liked me, and he liked my airplane collection. He would give out like these like airplanes, like these like fighter aircraft, if you get questions right. And I had like a whole like armada on my desk. I would line them up neatly and this and that. Like, he liked me. That was very helpful. That was in third grade. Thank God, that was really, really nice. And anyone else? In 10th grade, I had Rabbi Trapper, Rabbi Chaim Trapper, who liked me, and Rabbi Yochapaz in 12th grade.
See, now this is pretty amazing that you can be so specific with that over, you know, I know you're a little younger than me still, but, you know, older than Rabbi Bressler over here. So, like, I really want to know, like, as what would were these Rabbeim doing that reached you to a point where you said, I know this person likes me, as opposed to, I hear them saying they like me, but they don't mean it.
You know, as we were talking, I thought of Rabbi, I think his name is Winter, my first grade Rebbe. So I bumped into him at Yeshiva Chavetz Chaim. He was there. I think his daughter married a guy there. And I introduced myself to him. I recognized him. And Wender, maybe. W-E-R. Okay, it was first grade, guys. He cut me some slack. And I'm impressed. I recognized him. The point is I went over to him and said, introduced myself. Hi, I'm Nachi. Nachi Felt. I don't know if you remember me. I'm pretty sure I remember you. And I said, I just wanted to say hi and give you an update. I feel like you deserve to hear the Nachas. You know, I'm a professor now at Columbia and I have smicha from Yeshiva and doing a second smicha. And you're like, Baruch Hashem, writing a sefer, and just wanted to say thanks. And he, Gemara says, you don't get jealous of your kids and you're telling me them. It doesn't cover you guys, sorry. But so Rabbi Wender really really appreciated it. He got a little bit emotional and he held my hand and he said, you should know that I always liked you. And the reason why I became a Rebbe was because I was dyslexic. I felt like none of my Rebbeim believed in me when I was a kid. They all thought I was a loser. I didn't want any kid to have that. So that's why I became a first grade Rebbe.
Wow.
Again, I didn't necessarily feel that back then. So to answer your question, DJ, yeah, sometimes I didn't feel it. But I clearly had something positive that I saw him, remembered him, right? From like 20 years ago, 30, I don't even know how long that was, right? And went over to him and felt safe enough to tell him about how I'm doing. You know, like I did do that at one of the yeshivas I was expelled from, which I'll remain nameless, invited me as a speaker for a professional development day. That was fun because some of the teachers that taught me were in the audience and I was being introduced as, you know, professor of psychology and education, Rabbi Dr. Nachi Felt. Right, and I get up there, and as I stood on the podium, I looked down, and I was trying not to say it, but it slipped right out. DJ, you would totally relate. And I said, wow, karma can be pretty awesome. And yes, I am enjoying every second of this. And I launched into my whole procedure and made examples from the history I had in the school of things not to do and what things to do. I'm more focused on the positive because I'm a big fan of positivity and that kind of thing. And reminded them of things that they did and how well it was and how it could have been a little bit better if they had also done this, you know, that kind of focus. But I do remember that, like, it was kind of enjoyable. So some of them who did like me, I may not have been able to feel because of the DSA and the sensory, like all that stuff that was going on. Like, thinking about it, first grade, I was in a new school because I was already expelled from kindergarten, right? And, oh, Moralea was really nice to me in kindergarten, speaking of kindergarten.
So what we're seeing is that, let's assume, for those people, all of your teachers that are listening, right, who aren't named, there's probably some that were also forgotten, but the point being here that you did have...
Rabbi Hollander in San Diego also was really good to me.
You know, the more you're talking, the more I'm like, wait, hold on a second. Who didn't like you?
I still remember I was pretty, like, crazy in San Diego as well, but he always had a twinkle in his eye. And he was good to me also. I also felt like he liked me. But it's crazy. I don't remember what I learned. Nothing. I have no idea what we learned. Gemara, Mishnah, history, science. No idea. The only thing I remembered was whether or not that human being in front of the room liked me or not.
And it's so true. And it's like that's a saying that I've seen over and over and over again. Like no one remembers what you said, but they do remember how they made you feel.
So where does, first of all, this is awesome.
Hale, right? It's fun that each time we've done this, which I think this is our third time doing the same topic, it comes out so different. That's the freshness of ADHD. It's always fresh. Got to stay fresh.
But I do want, what we didn't touch on this time is that this whole Dionys piece, right? The whole Dionys piece of like what happened with like your Frumkeit and your learning. And
oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Became a Dion. I think you said at one point you were going to like, you were ready to give up. Gemara and
Yiddishkeit. I was ready to give it all in. Crazy. Like I was like, yeah, I was ready to throw it out.
At what stage?
16 or 17. I think 17. It was my first year at WITS, and it's a very intense yeshiva program. There's a lot of like really, really smart boys who come to the base mentors program. They attract like the best from the East Coast and throughout like the country. And here I was just going there because I was too young to go to Israel with the rest of my class, which thank God. But the point is that my parents said that I had to pick one place that to go that wasn't in Israel. And after I turned 18, then I could go to Israel. So that means I was stuck in the States for 2 years. So I was like, all right, let me do WITS. I had no idea that WITS was so intense. When I had visited, like I had come at night. So I did night theater. I chilled with like one or two guys from California, a San Diego boy and LA boy. That was nice. Slept over at Rabbi Zakkai's house. Went to like morning seder again, chilled with the guys, did shiur, and then headed straight to Romania. That was my entire WITS checking out experience. We stocked up on Romanian and flew back to LA.
Aside from basketball, you hit all the major high points there.
I was coming from Valley Torah. Their basketball wasn't going to do it for me. So what happened with is that, so I was sitting there day in, day out, feeling like a total misfit because, like, first of all, I was the only one still wearing American Eagle. I didn't get the memo that, like, that's only cool in high school. Not even. And then, so that was awkward. And then they all knew how to read Hebrew and Aramaic. I didn't even know what the heck Aramaic was. Like, what is this thing? Where is Aramaica? Like, what are we doing? This is just, and why is the print so small? It was so small, and you have to bend over and look at this giant tomb of like little words that dance in front of your face and say, "Hi, you can't read me." Na, 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 na.
For the kids listening, back in the day, the Gemara did not have nekudos in it like it does now, and it was very tiny lettering. So those of us really had to struggle.
The chemto shel toiger. So yeah, mamish odem ki yamus boil, and I felt like I was dead. I was kind of, I told you guys, I lived my life by Chazal, right? And I was Yomus Boyal. I was done. I was gone. I said, listen, Zui Torah v'Zui Schaira, like really, this is what I'm supposed to do, spend every day feeling like a moron. I'm not doing this. Like, get me out of here. So I called my dad and I think I pretty much said, yeah, if this is Yiddishkeit, I'm out. Like, what the heck is with this whole, like, if you want to be like a Jewish male, it's just like, come on, like, Shaloh Asani Isha. Whoa, 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 whoa. Let's give it a break here. They don't have school on Sundays. Let's talk. You know, like, so for me, it was very much like I felt like, you know, Koifin Aleng Harkigigis, you know, the giant Harsinai being held over my head. And I didn't really have a choice. There was no consent. And that was something that really bothered me. I think if I was like given the choice, maybe, but like still, I wouldn't have any idea of like what happened was that. So I remember cursing out my dad, telling him, I hate this. I hate Gemara. I hate Yiddishkeit. It's so not fair. It's so wrong. And also it didn't help all the Rebbeim snark, you know, snarky line about Gan Eden is learning. If you love it now, then you'll be able to enjoy it for the rest of eternity. But if you don't, that's your Gehenna also. That was a pretty intense conversation. I still remember it on the front lawn at WITS. And my father said back to me something which still resonates to this day and something that I highly recommend for many others with ADHD, which is none of this like wokey-dokey, like, oh, you're special. Oh, my gosh. You do you. He said, what? You think Torah is easy? You think learning's easy? I had to break my teeth when I was in Gateshead. Right, I also didn't know how to read. Right, I also didn't know how to do any of this. And you got to break yourself on it, and you got to try. You got to give it your best shot. If you don't give it your best shot, then that's just not fair to yourself. So I was like, all right, that's a pretty empowering speech. So I was like, all right, sweet. How much is my best shot to the end of this month? 5 years. Like, holy cow. Let's call it quits at 1 year at a time. So we did 1 year at a time. That was it. And he didn't let me go home for 1 year at a time. So I had to stick it out. Now I'm stuck in WITS. You do one of two things, right? You could either just go limp, right? Become a loser and give up and curse the gods of fate, which I'm sure some people do. And it's a very tempting. I hear that. I hear that actually, no judgment. Or you can man up and you can say, all right, I'm in this. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it right. So I remember getting like, you know, they give out all these like place marks that have like all the translations and stuff. And I came up with a system where I would write, instead of writing the English on top of the word, which meant that I never learned the word, I would just look at the English on top of the Aramaic word. I put the translations in the corner of my Gemara. This way I had to look at it in the corner, and knowing that our brain is constantly making shortcuts, it was much easier and more convenient for me to just memorize it.
Hold on a second. I'm lost here. You lost me because I mean, I get what you're saying, but you said earlier, right? ADHD, all we care about is my interests, right? What your father says, I had to break my teeth over it, just try a little harder. And now you're saying, well, so I just decided.
It is to try harder. He said, give it a fair shot. So now this became a challenge. And we're going to talk about in the clinical piece that there are four active ingredients to interest, the CNUs. There's challenging or competitive, new or novel, urgent, or stimulating. If you think of any marketing you've ever noticed ever in your entire life, it had one or more of these active ingredients, right? Challenging or competitive, call now before they're gone, right? That's urgency and competitive, right? Challenging, collect all seven Yoki Pokemons, right? What's the next one is new or novel, under new management or new design. Listen, buddy, your Fresca bottle, you're not convincing me. I know it's the same Fresca, all right? I remember the old print. I know. Right, in the clear Sprite thing, you're not fooling me. I remember when it was green, and yeah, it did taste better. Right, like this is all marketing. This is how we create interest. They want to make it new and novel so that you go, oh, look, right, Sprite. It's clear now. That's cool. Let me try that. Right, and then there's urgency, deadlines. This is why everything gets done in the last minute. Right, like somehow, thank God for the last minute. That's when everything gets done. But and then stimulating, you ever notice those dumb stores? They always have like the right, the open in many different colors of blinking lights. I got it. You're open. I got it. Right? Why do you have to have so many colors or like whatever other signs you see in many other cities or landmarks in this country, right, that are very shiny and bright? I'm just thinking of one that comes to mind, but I don't want to say it in front of your very holy audience. Right? Like there's like so much bright lights and like what? Why? Why do we need this? Right? Why is there a bright Home Depot with the weird gross orange? What's with that? The point is that like when something stands out and it's stimulating, that generates interest. So there are four ways, four active ingredients of interest. The CNUs, challenging or competitive, new or novel. The difference between new or novel is like steak, right? It's not new. We're only limited to the same kosher steaks. But novel is how you cook the steak. Right? It's different. Drop different. It's the same, right? Just a little bit different, right? The urgency and stimulating. And so here, this was a challenge. And there was a drop of urgency in the sense that, like, it was time-based. I just had to stick it out to the end of the year. Could I man up? By the end of the year, could I have improved that I could stick it out again? And it was challenging. It was like a he basically threw it out.
So even though you didn't have the inherent interest and it was tremendously daunting to you, this concept of sitting in base measures and learning.
Let me correct that. I did have the inherent interest. I was just stymied and blocked by my tremendous limitations, i.e. not able to read Hebrew or Aramaic, not able to sit still and do something, not able to handle the emotional torture of feeling like the stupidest guy in the shir, right? That's what was going on. So here, this just increased the level of interest. I think this is a very important point, and it's hard to make it over with just my voice, but I'll try to do my best, which is if you could imagine putting your hands in front of you, one hand beneath your chin, one hand above your chin, right? So whenever we're talking about any like motivation or any way to get any activation, right, there has to be either, right, more motivation than capability or more capability than motivation. So each one of those hands is either, right, ability or motivation. If I don't have the ability, so then I need to increase, move that hand higher above your nose, right? I need to increase the motivation. If I don't have so much motivation, I need to increase the ability so that it's just really easy to just do it and it's done. And then my father provided me with the boost, right? To raise the level of motivation over the level of ability until I'm Yirtzeh Hashem, poo, 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 Kanehara, right? I was able to create the ability, which is really the trick of how I did it. There's no like easy, like, just do this and you're good. It was backbreaking work, blood, sweat, and tears. Adam ki yamos ba'ol. Like, I really did kill myself on it. And I taught myself how to read every Shabbos out of Chazar, all of the Bekiyas I did that week. I had slowly trained myself to take a smaller nap. Every Shabbos I did 15 minutes less. I wouldn't let myself take the nap till I finished my Chazara quota. It took real work, but I was interested, and I'm a Navy SEAL. So I do whatever it takes to accomplish the mission, and I did.
So almost like you're saying that you're not. I wouldn't say you're an anomaly, but the difference between you staying on the derech and someone else not staying off the derech was that you became interested in learning, whereas that other person may not.
I don't like it as you became interested, is that I took on the challenge of learning how to
learn. Right, that stimulated you.
That stimulated the interest, that activated the interest. But I had to want to take it on as a challenge. I could have said, nah, heck with it. You know what? I'll pass. I'm not interested. Get me out of here.
That's exactly what I mean. You as an individual, for you, that worked. For someone else, the same exact scenario, for them, the take the challenge, that didn't interest them.
I feel like we're being very reductionist here, and whether or not it was interesting or not interesting. What, by going into the interest, I was explaining the mechanisms for how my brain was able to create more ability.
Oh, I see.
But be'etzem, it does come down to bechira. Right? I give you chaim and maves. Who the heck is going to choose maves? Right? No one's going to choose maves. The Torah says the only way that you can have real bechira is if both chaim and maves look equally attractive. So you're right. Everyone else in that situation would have the same opportunity presented to them, which is, which one are you going to choose, chaim or maves?
That sounds like a huge turning point in your life, right? Here you are. That one decision was either I'm going to say, forget it, dad, I'm out of here. Let me go do whatever I'm going to do. Right, I'm done with yeshiva. Or, oh, you know what? Let me dive in fully. And when I dive in fully, I go fully and then I become a dad.
It was 1 year at a time. It was 1 year at a time. It was just 1 year at a time.
Okay, fine. Yeah, understood. But we was zoning on that, as we would call it, bechira, or as we would call it, choice point.
Sure. Can I add one point before we add to this? Which is also, you'll see a key ingredient here was that I was able to have open dialogue with my father. It wasn't just I'm reporting to him, hey, I'm out, and then nothing. It's not like unilateral discussion. This was a dialogue between two people. And that clearly I had enough of a relationship with my father that I was almost in a way like subconsciously asking for help, and that the relationship wasn't so that I could hear his input. It wasn't like speaking from on high on this is what you shall do. So I think that's very important also for parents listening to this and for kids, right? Create that dialogue, both of you, right? But if your parents are not having it with you, go make dialogue with them, right? And if you're not having it with your kid, or I tried, he doesn't want to speak to me, figure out how to find out what this kid is interested in, and then start slow, start off with that stuff. Be interested in what he's interested in, join his life, be a part of him, show him you care about him and not just about him being on the derech, not just about him learning, not just about him being a perfect son, that you're interested in him.
What did your father do to show you that?
Because there's just like an easy formula, you mean?
No, what did your father do for you personally? What did he do that made you realize, oh, he's actually interested in me, not just in me learning?
He heard what I had to say, and like he heard me out, and throughout high school, we would walk to shul together back and forth when I'd kvetch about how dysfunctional high school was. He would like give me advice on how to take notes. He would learn with me every Shabbos. I remember I wouldn't get a blessed word of shir the whole week until Shabbos, when my father would teach it to me after Shachar. So we'd have herring and, you know, schnapps. I mean, and kiddush, kedem, kiddush. We would have kiddush.
Highest quality sparkling grape juice.
Yes, or worse, the manischewitz, or even nastier than that, the Rashi one. Right. And then he would teach it to me. I remember they would give out quizzes. The Rebbe would give out tests on the Gemara, and he would have like three levels, like gold, silver, copper. I would get wood, like the wood level.
But what's screaming so loud to me is that you still had some buy-in.
I'm a fighter. I'm not going to just give up. Don't give in, because Shizzle does not give up. I wasn't just going to give in. I was going to reach deep inside of me and pull that stuff out of me to not give in, to not give up.
And that sounds like something inherently about you. Is that about you, or is that something that was fostered?
I don't know.
Right? Because even in that last point, like, how many parents listening to this might say, I would sit with my son and learn and teach him everything they did all week, but my son doesn't want that.
Yeah, he might not want that. And you have to ask him what he does want and do that with him, even if it's not as gishmak.
Even if it's not about the learning, even if it's something else, but to find what he does want from you.
Yeah, show him that you want him.
Wow, very powerful.
Are we going to add a link to Eminem's song, Till I Collapse? Because that's a great song.
Really, really, really a lot to process here. And I want to get back to that point we were making a minute ago, though, was this choice point, right? This point of bechira that you had, which was, how old were you when this conversation took place?
17.
17-year-old father coming to you saying, just give it another shot, a year at a time. Right? You had the opportunity there to just say, and it sounds like with your history, plenty. No,
I didn't really have the opportunity. What was I going to do? Like, I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. What was I going to do? Walk back to LA? Like, I really didn't have the choice. Like, I didn't, like, what was I going to do? The only person I knew in Chicago then, I think, was Morty Reisman, and he had only girls. So I wasn't allowed to go to that house. So I was basically stuck.
But I think you did have a choice, because you could have set the building on fire. Not to pick on your arsonist past, but like, you could have.
It's like way too socially off, but yeah, there is bechira. And again, this all comes down to that self-identity. Like, I viewed myself as a Navy SEAL. I'm hardcore. I don't give up. I don't give in. I do what I want to do, and I'm not going to stop till I do it, till I collapse.
And you wanted this, and
I wanted to be a winner, not Yiddishkeit. You think I wanted Hashem? I mean, sorry. I just wanted to not feel like a loser. And so that's why I said I'm going to fight, because I don't want to give up without a fight. Like, so what am I going to do? Just give in and say, all right, to heck with this, I'm not even going to try. I mean, I could have done that, I guess, technically, but I just, like, what would have made me feel better? It comes down to this idea of structure. I'm very into that people with ADHD need structure. They need more structure than others. My chavrusa ended up becoming one of the world experts in Gittin. He called me up once. He's like, Rabbi Doctor, which I know means, oh, great, it's going to be a psychological problem. And he said, I have a guy who we're trying to send hazmanas to, right? And so if you did Chosha Mishpat, you know that you send, like, 3 hazmanas. And after that, right, then he goes into contempt of the court and, you know, all sorts of stuff. The point is that there's a process here. So he's like, we sent the 3 hazmanas, but he has ADHD, so should we keep extending the deadline? And I said, heck no. Right? Nope. It doesn't work like that. They need structure. People with ADHD, they need structure. If you keep giving them accommodations, right, and you keep, like, making more, like, oh, yeah, sure, we'll just bend over again for you. It's not going to work because we need the structure. We're not going to be interested if there's no urgency. We're not going to be interested if there's nothing real. It's not challenging or competitive. It has to be real. There has to be real structure. If it's not there, we're not going to boom. We just can't. Like, nothing's going to activate us to move forward. And so I feel like that's a part of this also, is that my father basically said, you don't really have a choice. You're stuck there to the end of the year. You got to figure it out. Well, it really is till Pesach, but, like, whatever.
And so it wasn't really a choice of leaving or doing something else. It was a choice of, okay, like you said, okay, I'm here. I could either make mayhem and cause mayhem and make everyone's lives miserable and make my rabbi's lives miserable.
Or check out. That's the usually the venue of choice.
Or check out.
You borrow your friend's iPad or whatever it is with movies, and you just go into movie land and la, 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 and their babes soon learn to stop trying to wake you up. And it's over.
Right. Or check out, or say what you said, which is, I'm here anyway. I'm going to give it a shot.
Yeah. I had a great line to a client who did not appreciate this and ended up firing me and calling my Rebbe and saying that I was inappropriate. But I told her that she also was like, very like, yeah, I don't know what to do. I feel like I should just want to check out. And again, my nature is, right? I said, well, listen, lady, right? I didn't say it like that, but maybe I did say it like that. And that's why she got insulted. So that's fair on her part. But the point is that I said, listen, life is like an airport. Either you check in or you check out. And that's up to you. Where do you want to go? Where do you want to fly? Do you want to check out or check in? You take all your baggage and all the problems of your life, and you have to figure out, where do I want to go with this? Do I want to check out or do I want to check in? I thought it was an excellent line. Clearly wasn't so appreciated by her. But I do think that was my attitude then also, is I could check out or check in.
I think it's an extremely powerful line. I think it makes a lot of sense. And what I mean, I cannot say this, but hearing you say this with all of your, to fit the airport marshal baggage, right? So all of your baggage, you had every right, so to speak, to check out. Nobody could have blamed you had you checked out. And yet you said, what's going to happen if I check out? Where's my life trajectory going to go? I'm going to check in. I'm going to give it a shot. You gave it a shot. And that's how you became a Dayan, a doctor, and now helping those in the same situation.
You're very into this dying thing. I'm more impressed that, like, I got a PhD and, like, I'm making money and not just some, like, I don't know what. Like,
I'll tell you what impresses me, honestly, about the dying piece. I mean, yes, of course the PhD impresses me also. And just so you know, we're very impressed in all regards, right? But but what impresses me about the dying that I keep harping on is the emotions pent up. Like you said, Dr. Fox's point of the rage you had, and the rage you had, and the ability to sidestep that rage or to deal with that rage or say, not let that rage dictate your life's decisions, to me is really, really incredible.
Full disclosure, and I'm sorry for ruining the, like, inspirational aspect of this beautiful podcast. I mostly did the smicha because I wanted to graduate, because I wanted to win. Again, like, I don't know if you're catching my theme here. I'm a Navy SEAL. I'm a fighter. I'm a winner. I don't want to lose. I don't like losing. I'm competitive, right? Meaning I'm able to generate my own interest. I'm able to manufacture my own activation.
Sure.
And to me, I didn't want to end yeshiva without winning. The way you win is you get smicha. Now, if I'm going to do it, I want to win all the way. right? I don't want to get some cheesy smicha that you do or chves or whatever. I'm not going to rip any other people's smichas. But I want to do yoredeya, yore, yadin, yadin, choshem, mishpat, the whole thing, the whole shebang, right? I remember chazering. I would do the, on Shabbos, from Friday night till Matzah Shabbos, every single Shabbos, I'd chazer all of the Mechaber Ramaz that I did that week, right? It's a similar throwback to my good old days in Witz when I would chazer Bikias. And I would start the beginning of Shabbos. I wouldn't even eat the meals with my family. I was like Reb Chaim Poshit, you know, like the sefer at the table. I'm kidding. No, I had the meal, but it was just very short. We had a very short meal. When I was the meal, I was all in on the meal, right? I want to hear about what the kids learned on Shabbos and Chavis, right? But there was no sitting around, you know, kibitzing. Like, I didn't have time for, ain't nobody got time for that, right? So I was just like, hustle, right? We had 20-minute meals. Now I would just learn, right? And I had a quota of what I needed to finish Friday night, what I needed to finish before lunch, what I needed to finish before Mincha. And then after Mincha was, I just got to finish it before Abdallah. Right, I'll make Abdullah for the family or something like that, but like I wouldn't allow myself to eat or whatever until I finished my quotas. So like that was clearly pretty nuts because I was also full-time in yeshiva doing my internship, which means I was seeing people outside during non-seder hours and writing my dissertation from 11 to 3 a.m., right? So it was 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., right? So I was also doing a lot. Thank God for Ritalin, folks. But like the point is that to me, like it, the Dionysus wasn't like a me and Hashem were boys. It was me and myself. I'm a winner. I want to win. And I feel like that's a lot of how I did Yiddishkeit. Like I'm thinking about like davening. I hate going to davening and just mumbling words that I don't know what I'm saying. I hate that. It makes me feel like a loser. And I don't like being a loser. So I made a whole like davening thing. I called it I Daven. Get it? Cute. Right. And we went through this whole thing. I have this really cool thing that a lot of people found helpful to this day called iModem, where you personalize modem and you thank Hashem for three things. I remember like the first time I did it, I thanked Hashem that they had donuts for Rosh Chodesh that day. Yum. Love free donuts. Right. That I'm alive and healthy and have like a functional family. That was really, really meaningful to me. And the Yankees won. I personalized it. It was real. I was making my relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu real. I was sick and tired of this fake, like, oh yeah, Kadosh Baruch Hu, Melch, Malchi, I'm Lachim. He loves you. He loves you. I don't know. To me, it was like Morgan Freeman wearing white. Like, something wasn't right. It didn't fit. That's not my God, you know? So, like, something was off, right? So, I wanted to make davening real to me. I wanted to make davening great again. And so, I did that. I made that great. But, like, for me, it's not about, like, Yiddishkeit so much as it's about me. And I feel like that's the core difference. And what spelled the difference between like my success in Yiddishkeit versus other people not doing it is that they externalize it. And it's like me, and then there's Yiddishkeit as a separate thing. To me, it's all the same thing. You're stuck with Yiddishkeit whether you like it or not, right? We all know this, right? They're coming for you. They got you tagged. It's over. Done, right? You're in the database. You're in there. You're a Jew now forever. Again, you could choose not to believe it, but the body keeps score, right? And so like once you're in it, what do you want to do with that? To me, I don't like feeling like a loser. I don't like feeling like I'm half-baking it. Therefore, for me, I want to go all in. And I want to do it the right way. And so that's how I did all these things, right? So, like, I wanted to do yeshiva. I did yeshiva right. I made sure to chazer my bekiyas. I would stay up till 2 in the morning writing over the shiur until I could feel what the Rebbe was saying. Not just I could know what he's saying. Not just I could tell you what he's saying. I wanted to feel the movement in the Gemara. How did we get from this kasha to that teretz? For 3 weeks, we totally had no idea how Rabbi Akiva Eger would explain that migu, and now I get it. I get it. Not just I could tell you, Svara, I feel it. I wanted to feel it in my bones. If I didn't feel it, it wasn't real. It's not enough for me. I wasn't going to settle.
We're gonna wrap up for everyone's sake, but also because we don't want to make the episode too long. But the one thing I do want to end with on this note, Deej, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to throw in before also. But I'm listening to this story and I'm inspired. I'm hearing a boy who really went on a wild journey and had many opportunities to check out and chose to check in and made what you wanted of your life. And if I'm a parent listening, or if I'm even an individual with ADHD listening, what you're describing to me, maybe I'm wrong, tell me if I'm wrong, sounds somewhat extreme, meaning both in terms of your experience of ADHD and in terms of your mentality, right? Your ability to do that. So what would you say to quote unquote the average listener who's struggling with ADHD and really having this trouble, whether it was with themselves or their child, like, what would you say to that person?
I would quote the great Godel, Marshall Mathers, again, and I would say, you only got one shot. You just got to lose yourself in the moment and own it and never let it go. You know what? If you don't make it extreme, it's not going to be stimulating. This isn't just a game that, like, I happen to be playing throughout my life. I made it a game, and I got into the game, and I owned the game. But if you don't do that, then yeah, I probably would have led a life of lackluster mediocrity, and we would not be having this podcast at all. I would just be another person floating through shuls, cracking jokes during Chazaras HaShatz, and being cynical on anything rabbinic or Jewish or structured or functional at all. And that's the choice, really, we all have. And I don't think it's so extreme. Yeah, it sounds like it's extreme because I cherry-picked for you all the geschmack stuff and didn't bother telling you about all the mundane, like, the mundane minutiae of life. Yeah, but, you know, most of life, right, is filled with mundane minutiae, right? And really, if you think about it, it really does come down to this choice of whether or not I want to make something of this or not. If you make it extreme and fun and exciting, then yeah, your brain will work for you instead of you being a slave to your stimulations. You hear what I'm saying, Yechiel? My answer to you is that it does sound extreme, A, because we cherry-picked it, but B, because that's the only way to get my brain turned on. And that's the only way to do it. No, you can't just lackluster your way through life and expect things to happen. And that's a key yesod, and we should pick up with this when we start again. And I find this in marriage counseling and in the personal work that I do with individuals and with parenting. It's the same yesod. Ready? Gotta step it up. If you don't step up, no one's going to step up for you. Im'ein, ani, li, mi, li. But that's the yesod. I have it mamash in my notebooks from when I was 15. I have these notebooks every Saturday night. I would do a chesra nefesh. Where do I want to go this week? What do I want to accomplish this week? I used to call it SWAT, special weapons and tactics. I try to go through, what did I want to do that week? Right, again, same thing. I was trying to get that muscular, manly, testosterone-fueled koyach ha-taiva, right, into this thing. I made it all of me. It's not just there's me and the Torah, right? Yisrov ha-raisa chadhu. It's one. And you have to, when you recognize that this is me and this is all of me, that can allow you to dehair that that's the only way for me to succeed, is that you can't run away from it. The idea is to just make it your own and to own it and to never let it go.
That's what's speaking to me. You're saying that a person with ADHD, there's no way around it. This is what it is. So you can either try to
run away, take a pill, and hope that it's going to make you better. It's not. It'll help. I mean, pills don't teach skills. I have to do all this crazy stuff even while heavily medicated.
Right. So learning to manage it and also to embrace it and to say, this is me. How can I just fight through it? And how can I learn to foster that into making me even greater?
Right. Noch besser, I would say, that it really goes in the opposite order. The sooner we embrace it, the sooner we can manage it.
Dr. Feld, thank you so much. Really appreciate part one.
Alrighty, thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mental Health Matters. Keep an eye out for the next episode as we continue the conversation about the mental health topics that you need to know. Don't forget to subscribe so you can make sure you catch every episode. See you next time.